And that's what happens to a lot of people. They chase the money, or they chase something which they think is what they want, and they think it's going to make them happy and fulfilled. But they get to the top after putting in all this work, thinking this is going to be the pinnacle. But then they realize once they get there, they still have that deep sense of unfulfillment. And they realize it's like, fuck, I just wasted the last 20 years of my life.
Alrighty, welcome to the Ryan Tan Show. My guest today is James Harrison. James is an entrepreneur and a curious high performer who has spent the last few years embarking on self-development. James started his professional working life in door-to-door sales before moving into customer loyalty while simultaneously starting a small online business selling habit planners. Today, James works in an e-commerce business and is a host of his podcast, The James Harrison Show, where he interviews startup founders and top performers. As part of James's self-development journey, he's read over 100 books, envisioned and documented his dream life, and one of the most profound things he's done so far is embarked on a 10-day Vipassana meditation retreat just over a year ago. So with all that said, welcome to the show, James.
Thank you so much, Ryan. So happy to be here and be a guest of your brand new podcast. Thanks for having me.
For sure, man. I appreciate you coming on. So why don't we start off with Vipassana meditation, man? It's something that I don't think many people know exactly what it's about. It's becoming somewhat of a buzzword. How would you describe, you know, the retreat and what you did?
Yeah, dude. So Vipassana meditation, it's interesting, man, because people often think of retreats or meditation or like some sort of spiritual retreat, and they think of it as a really nice, relaxing, like comforting thing where you basically go away for a few days and into the forest somewhere, and maybe you do like a bit of stretching and some light meditation or whatever, and you come out feeling very zen and relaxed. And, you know, it's funny with Vipassana because it's actually, as you would know, having done it yourself as well, an extremely challenging sort of raw look into the deep, dark depths of your mind. And you sort of have to look at some places that you've never even realized were there before. And I guess the whole idea behind it is that in our lives, whenever we experience any sort of misery, it's due to some sort of external thing that's happening to us. The cause of that misery and that suffering is not actually the external stimulus that's happening to us. It's our own internal reaction to that. So an example I always give is, for example, let's say you're driving along and someone cuts you off and you get really angry at that person. The average person would say like, oh, that person doing that made me angry at them. But what it actually is your internal reaction to that external event. So you're actually making yourself angry. And the whole idea of Vipassana, it's a meditation technique where you basically train your mind to just observe feelings and sensations objectively so that you can not have a craving and not have a craving for good things and not have an aversion to bad things. And just see things objectively for what they are without judgment and just let them process through you. So it's not about like removing or like numbing your emotions or anything like that. It's just about seeing things for what they are and then dealing with them accordingly without causing suffering or misery for yourself. So that's kind of how I would define it.
Yeah, that's super powerful, man. I love it. And I did a retreat myself about 3 months ago. So yeah, it's crazy, man. I think it's actually hard to summarize the benefits. I think every person will get their own experience. And, you know, we've had mutual friends who have had similar experiences, but also different learnings. You know, to start off this Vipassana meditation, you have to actually start off with a 10-day retreat, and that's meditating for 10 hours a day. So you're actually meditating for, you know, 100 plus hours on this retreat. You know, how was that experience for you? I mean, because you've done some meditation before, right?
Yeah, man. It's crazy because, yeah, I had done some light meditation before just using like apps like Headspace and all these kind of things, just mindfulness meditation where you just sort of try to observe the breath and then as your mind wanders, bring it back to the breath and it sort of helps you calm and focus your mind. So I'd done a small amount of meditation, but, you know, you sit down for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or like a long session for me was 20 minutes, and that was crazy when I was just using the apps. But as you said, with Vipassana, you have to go and do this 10-day course to learn the technique, because it actually takes 10 days and full immersion to actually learn. Because, and that's one of the biggest things about Vipassana, is that it really is experiential. You can logically understand and know that it makes sense. Like that example before I gave, some people would hear that and they'd sort of wrap their heads around it logically and say like, okay, yeah, I understand that that external thing has happened and then I reacted in a certain way and I shouldn't do that. They can conceptually understand it logically, but then when it actually happens, it's hard to actually put that into practice. So you actually need these 10 days to train your mind to actually be less reactive and just see things more objectively. So yeah, it was crazy, dude. Like, just going in, as you said, 10 hours a day, it's already a crazy amount of time. And you're basically just sitting cross-legged for 10 hours a day and meditating. And people, some people, when I went into it, I told some people that, and their initial reaction was, oh, that sounds really relaxing. Like, you just sort of chill and sit there. But it's very different, yeah, as you would know, than just like sitting in a chair or sitting on a couch watching TV or something. It's actually very brain power intensive to meditate properly, especially using this technique, because the whole idea is to actually remain present and focus on the sensations in your body, which aren't always comfortable. There's a lot of things that come up emotionally and physically. So like trauma from the past can come up, physical pain in the moment of sitting cross-legged. If anyone listening has ever tried to sit cross-legged for 1 hour without moving, they'll know how painful that is. And so, and trying to like do that and stay non-reactive is very challenging and mentally draining. So yeah, it's a wild experience, man. It's very unlike anything else. And I still don't think can do a good job of explaining exactly what the experience is like to people who haven't done it, because it really is something that you kind of have to go through yourself. And as you said, everyone has a different reaction and a different experience and takes away different things. And I think that's one of the things that really appealed to me, is that it was something that seemed so foreign and so challenging and just unlike anything else that I'd heard of. And that is something that just appeals to me and makes me want to test it out.
Yeah, totally, man. It's really interesting. And I guess with meditation, sometimes there's a misconception. People feel that, you know, I should not be thinking about anything. And the way that Headspace, you know, Andy Puddlecombe, the way he talks about it, and mindfulness meditation, is that meditation and mindfulness is not about blocking out the thoughts. It's more about being present and, I guess, seeing them as clouds in the sky, seeing these thoughts pass by, becoming comfortable with them. And as like you said, not having a judgment, you know, not having this craving or aversion to want to get rid of them, but kind of welcoming their presence. So with Vipassana, you know, can you explain how the meditation works? Because there's three meditations. You've got the Anapana, which is like the breathing. You've got the Vipassana, and then there's one called Metta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, man. So the first 2 days of the retreat is, and this is the whole thing about any of these sort of immersive experiences, the first portion of them, whether they're 10 days or whether it's like a holiday or something, it always takes a good portion of time to actually just settle in and get into a new routine. And so literally the first 2 days of this 10-day retreat is practicing Anapana meditation, like you said, which is literally just observing the breath and the sensations that come from that as you just sit. So just, you're literally just sitting cross-legged, breathing in and out of your nose naturally. There's no special breathing technique. It's just however you breathe. And all you have to do is just observe that breath and keep your attention on it. So feeling it come in and out of your nostrils, like noticing, is it coming in your left nostril, your right nostril, both nostrils? What does that feel like? What's the sensation? And just keeping your attention on that. And then if your attention wanders, which it will, just noticing when it does that, and then bring the attention back to the breath. And so literally for 2 days, so 20 hours total of meditation over the first 2 days, that's all you're doing. You're literally just sitting there, just observing your breath. And even that sounds pretty wild to some people, but the whole point of that is that you're literally just calming the mind, because you come in out of the modern world, you know, you've got overstimulation, over distraction. You got your phone, you got work, you got people, responsibilities, things happening. You got to go here, got to go there. there's just so much input and so much stimulation. It's just literally just overloading our brain. Dopamine's just going crazy. Our receptors are just like, adrenal glands are fatigued, all this crazy stuff. And so you actually need that 2 days just to literally quieten the mind, get rid of all that stuff, and just become more centered and balanced and open up your mind and allow it to be able to receive the learnings of the next meditation technique, which is Vipassana, which is what you learn next. And Vipassana is basically what I was saying at the start, that objective, non-judgmental observation of sensations in your body. So basically, the quick version of it is you essentially sit in the meditation pose and all you're doing is scanning up and down the body. So you start at the top of your head, scan down the back of your head, scan down the front of your face. Just notice every single muscle, every single sensation you feel. So whether that's like a tingling feeling or, you know, it might be like a cold or a warm sensation, whatever that is, just observe it without judgment. And then, like, it might even be a painful sensation. Like if you're sitting cross-legged, you feel there's a pressure on your leg. And the whole point of it is just to scan up and down the body, just observe whatever you feel and whatever the sensation is, and try not to have a judgment of it. Try not to judge it as good or bad. Just see it for what it is. Because when you think about it, what is pain? Pain is just a sensation, but we assign a judgment to it by saying it's a bad thing or a negative thing. And so by practicing Vipassana and just seeing things objectively, we just help remove that judgment. And then obviously that translates into other areas of life. So that's kind of the bulk of the course. So from day 3 onwards. And then the last one you said, metta, which is sort of like, I guess you'd say it's more kind of just giving thanks and love into the universe in a way, as hippie as that sounds. It's like just kind of, you know, because again, we always get back what we give out. And so in a way, it's just a way to consciously just have this like aura of gratitude and love that you project outwards. And it's just puts you in the best sort of state of mind to live, essentially.
Yeah, like you said, it's a big cleanse because, I guess, to give some background and context, when you go into this, you know, 10-day Vipassana meditation retreat, you're basically, you know, surrendering all possessions. Your car keys are taken, your wallet's taken, your phone's taken, but also things like no reading, no writing, like no journaling when you're in this meditation retreat. And the other thing is that there's no eye contact with the participants for the first 9 days. So if you think about it, it does sound a bit cultish. You know, I had people saying that to me and... But it is such an experience, as you said, you know, like a dopamine detox, because we're overstimulated in the modern world by all this stuff. So that kind of cleanses us out.
And think about how often do you even go 1 hour without getting some sort of stimulation from something external, whether it's like, even let's say you even turn off your phone and you don't have that on. You still got, you know, go to make something in the kitchen, you're making food or whatever. Maybe you're talking to someone on the phone, whatever the case is, driving somewhere. There's always something stimulating us. And then obviously when you introduce phone, TV, internet, that's just a whole nother level. This is literally just removing all stimulation and distraction. And it's actually quite scary because think of how stimulated we are in the modern world. And then suddenly you just have all this blank space. Your brain just is craving some sort of stimulation or distraction and it just can't find it because you're literally just there to meditate. Even in the breaks, like you said, you can't talk to anyone, you can't look at anyone. All you can do is just, you're not allowed to exercise either, you're not allowed to read or write. So all you're doing is literally just standing there, like maybe you just walk around the grounds or whatever of the meditation center, and then you just go back and meditate, and that's your life. There's literally nothing else you do. Other people cook your meals, so you don't have to, there's no like distraction of like having to mess about cooking or anything like that. It's just pure 10 days of uninterrupted, completely focused, fully immersive meditation. And it's just a scenario that just never happens in the modern world. And so it's quite wild, man.
Definitely. I remember my experience, and I think you could safely say that people like you and me were, you know, introverts at heart. We've got extroverted tendencies and we're happy, you know, and we, you could even say, thrive spending time by ourselves. So we're quite comfortable with that. But even then, you know, I felt for myself, when you're confronted with yourself, those inner demons come out. You know, you've actually got to sit down and you've got no stimulation. You've got no escapism routes. You've actually got to, you know, confront what is going on there. I mean, what was that like for you? You know, what came up? Because in Vipassana, they call it, I think, the term sankharas, where when you're, you know, meditating and you're, you know, kind of not having this craving and aversion, they call them sankharas. So when we have craving and aversion in the body, we create sankharas, which basically they're like deep-rooted. I don't know if you call them wounds, but they're basically, how would you describe the sankharas?
Yeah, dude. I think I love the way that he describes them in the course, which is basically like, these sankharas, so a visual example is, think of when you, let's say you go to the beach and you have like a stick and you draw a line in the sand. And so that's like a groove that you've imprinted into the ground, but it's not deep. It's not permanent. The waves come in and then straight away it's just washed away and then you've got a nice clean beach again. So it's a very impermanent state. And when you think about the mind, that's what happens on a day-to-day basis, like something perceived bad happens and it creates this sankhara. So basically a stick gets drawn in the sand of your mind. And in a healthy mind, the waves come in and they wash it away and you have a clean mind again. But what happens to most of us is that we get these sankharas and they start off just in the sand, but then eventually we don't face them. We don't let those waves come in and wash them away. And eventually what happens is that eventually the sankharas get deeper. And so then you can start thinking of it as like someone chisels out a line in a rock. And so then a rock, when you have a wave come over, it doesn't get rid of it like it does in the sand. And so these are all these sort of like deep rooted issues that started off as small things. And this is why it's like so important to understand, like in your childhood, all these like small emotional charges, because what starts as a small groove in the sand, over time, if we don't know how to face it, we're not emotionally mature enough to look deep and actually process it and deal with it. That's when it starts getting imprinted into the rocks of our mind. And it's just like, eventually it gets to a point where it's so deeply ingrained that it's very difficult to undo that or get rid of it. And that's why you see, man, it's like people who like are older, usually they're stuck in their ways. For better or for worse, if they have good habits, they're stuck in their good habits and they'll keep them going. But it's very hard for an old dog to learn a new trick, as the saying goes. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of what they describe as these sankharas, these small emotional wounds. And like you said, the main reason they usually get pushed down is that we're not willing to face them. Because if we would just face them when they're small, we just get rid of them. But the longer we leave it and the more we numb ourselves with alcohol, drugs, sex, whatever, just the deeper and deeper they get because we never face them and process them. And eventually it gets to a point where they're so deeply ingrained that we don't even realize they're there. And that's what fucks up most people's lives. So it's important to, everyone's got something and some things are deeper rooted than others, but it's so important to just face them and process them and let those waves come in and just wash it away, you know? And that's what this technique does.
Yes, I believe that. You know, on my retreat, it's interesting. Like my experience with the sankhara, as you could say, is that with no external stimulation, it's crazy, man. Like people's faces that I haven't seen for 5 to 15 years, even from early childhood, or names that have been floating around, or even old colleagues that weren't recent. It's like bubbles, man. These bubbles came up to the surface, or even just experiences, even if there were like micro conversations or micro interactions with people in the school playground, like, you know, many, a long, long time ago. It's crazy. They all popped up. And what that tells me is that they're, again, without, you know, taking this time deliberately out of the modern life and, you know, putting yourself in an environment that's conducive to releasing these sankharas, it's going to be very hard. And I think I'm quite self-aware, but I wasn't even aware these things were there. And, you know, there's a lot of things bubbling in people's mind. So What was the experience for you like in terms of, you know, because some people cry in Vipassana, they've got like traumas or things that pop up or just, you know, elements. What was it for you that popped up and how did you find your experience, you know, especially once you entered that, you know, Vipassana meditation?
Yeah, for sure, dude. I had an interesting experience. It was because one of the things that I find very difficult just in everyday life is that I find it very difficult to cry and release my emotions. And there's a few reasons for that. One is the, I guess, just societal conditioning of what a man should be and what they should and shouldn't do in terms of expressing emotions is something that's been sort of deeply rooted into me since childhood. And so that's sort of the main thing. And so, you know, I find it very hard just on a day-to-day basis. If I feel like this sense of sadness, I can't just let that surface and express itself. Or I find it very difficult to, especially in the past, like, you know, in school, like I didn't want to cry in front of people because then people would like tease you or think you're weak or whatever. So my like initial reaction, and it's like so ingrained deeply inside of me, is that every time I feel like these emotions coming up where I need to healthily, like I should just release them and let them come out, my habitual response is to just squash them back down and just like push them deeper so that they don't come out. And think of it as like you've got a hose and water's flowing through it. All I'm doing is just kinking the hose. And so, yes, it does stop those emotions coming out or the water coming out. But then think of all the pressure that's building up there now. And this is like emotional pressure, which is just building, building, building. And the pressure has to come out somewhere. So if you're not letting it out through a healthy way and just expressing it, it's going to come out some other way, whether the hose is going to burst or, you know, it can manifest as some illness or maybe it manifests itself as anger, which you then take out on someone else, whatever the case is. So for me, I had these experiences of, you know, when all this stuff was, all this external distraction was taken away and I just had this blank space, like you said, all these things just came to the surface and the environment is just like conducive to allow that to come out. And it did for me. So I had these experiences where I'd just be sitting meditating and suddenly without even knowing why, I'd just start crying, like just tears would start coming out of my eyes. I wouldn't be like sobbing or anything, but, you know, I just feel the sadness come up and then just tears start coming out and I'd be thinking, oh, like what's going on here? Because you don't like necessarily connect the dots straight away. It's just like you're actually allowing yourself to feel your emotions and express them. And I had one experience as well where I was just walking throughout the grounds on one of the breaks and I just had this like overwhelming sense of sadness. And I remember I hadn't felt like this in a long time. I can't even remember the last time I felt like this. And I just basically was overwhelmed and just started bawling my eyes out. You know, there's like snot dripping out of my nose and I was just like crying. And I just had to like, I had to literally just sit down and just cry. But then the amazing thing is you do it for 5 minutes, it's passes, like all the emotions come out and it's gone. And then I just stood up and I felt amazing. And I felt like it had just passed. And then I just kept going on with my day. And so it's crazy, dude. It's like all these blockages that we have and which I had, which have came from various experiences in the past, which I hadn't been willing to face. Once I did face them and allow them to process, it just cleared up these emotional kinks. And I just felt so much lighter, man, so much lighter emotionally.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. And the effects of when you come back to society, I mean, day 10 is interesting of Vipassana. It's like they call it a, what do they call it? Like a cushioning impact, because they say that, you know, you haven't looked anyone in the eye. You've, you know, been doing this deep, they call it a surgical operation of the mind, which it is, you know, it's actually quite deep. And day 10 is like meant to be a buffer. You know, you kind of talk to people again, look them in the eye. And when they said that, you know, from a place of, I guess, being humble, I actually genuinely thought, look, I don't need this day 10. You know, I think I'll be fine because, you know, like I felt fine inside and all that, but little behold, you know, when day 10 came, I was actually reading the banners down. I did mine in the Blue Mountains. So near the dining hall, they have these books and all these posters and stuff. And you know, the donations guy just asked me a question. He's like, how's your retreat? And for me, it was crazy, man. Like I actually had like tears come into my eye. I didn't like actually cry. I tried to hold it back for in that moment. But it's crazy, man. And then, you know, when I was seeing those other people and just like having those brief convos, it's almost like I couldn't take it. And I guess that makes sense, you know, because there's a good book by Matt Lieberman called Social, How Our Brains Are Wired to Connect. And it's true that, you know, if we've, you know, taken ourselves out of the environment for like, you know, 9 days, what do you expect? You can't just come right back into society and expect to operate normally.
Yeah, dude. And it was good to have that buffer, because I can imagine if you just get chucked straight back into modern world, modern society, it would be quite a shock. So yeah, I was grateful for that day as well, as it eased back in.
Definitely. And how do you feel, I guess, coming back to society now? You know, you've learned the concept of the Vipassana, and also, I guess, staying in balance away from excessive craving, excessive aversion. How do you feel? And, you know, it's been nearly a year. It's been, I think it's a bit more than a year since you've done it. How have you felt, you know, when you came out, and also throughout the year, have those effects lasted and whatnot?
Yeah, I love the question, man. Because I think a lot of people, or some people, when I talked about this situation and especially how I felt after I came back, I could tell, man, some people were quite cynical, because, and I don't blame them, because a lot of, I don't consider this like a self-help kind of thing. It's like, it's a legit thing, but you go to a lot of like, say, a self-help seminar, and they'll pump you up for a few days and you feel really good, but then you come back into your daily life and you just fall back into the same habits and the same things that you did before. And it's not long before you're back to where you were. However, with this experience, I really do feel like there's been permanent shifts in my brain and my mindset. And that's not to say that there's no work. Like, I actually try to meditate on a daily basis now and practice the technique, because the reality is you can't just go do a 10-day retreat, come back, and then suddenly life's great. It is like an ongoing practice. But there's perspective shifts I've had which will stay with me forever. I'll give you an example. Like, a lot of people say that, for example, happiness is in the present moment. You know, the future doesn't exist. The past is in the past and doesn't exist anymore. All that exists is right now in the present. And therefore, you can choose to be happy right now and with what you have. And it's not something that's you to be attained in the future, or something that you did have in the past that, or there's something bad that happened which took it from you. It's all about what's happening in the present moment. And people say that, and most people, again, can logically wrap their heads around it and think that that does sound right and that it does sound correct. And I was the same before. I was like, yeah, that sounds correct. But, you know, there were times in the past where I wasn't happy. But now I've actually had the experience of, like, for example, on day 8 of the retreat, day 8 and day 9, I had literally nothing. I didn't have any possessions in that moment. I was literally just had the clothes on my back, a very basic bed, basic food. I didn't have any people, didn't have any relationships. And I can't even describe the state I was in then in terms of my levels of contentment and happiness. It was crazy, dude. Like, I was actually so happy in that moment. I remember thinking that if I just spend the rest of my life in this state, like here in this moment, this is actually all I need, you know? And so I didn't just logically think that happiness is in the present moment. I actually experienced the fact that happiness was in the present moment. And once you see something like that, you can't unsee it, you know? Like, that's always going to be in my mind, remembering that happened. And it may not happen every day, because, you know, you come into the modern world, there's reality, things are happening to you, there's stuff going on, blah, blah, blah. But I can always look back and remember that I did have that experience. And it just helps me understand for myself that, like, yes, that is the case, that I shouldn't be just like projecting into the future and just trying to chase all these things and make all these things happen, thinking that they'll make me happy. I need to be happy right now with what I've got. And sure, I'm still going to strive to achieve things and do things, and I'm confident I will, but I don't need them to be happy right now. You know, there's a big difference between those two things. So that's one of the biggest things I learned. And keeping up the practice throughout this year has helped me stay very balanced. This year, especially 2020, has been a big test of equanimity for a lot of people. We've had, you know, like me being in Melbourne here, we've been in lockdown for the past, I think, 9 weeks. So we're not even supposed to leave our house except like once a day. not allowed to see anyone, all this kind of crap. And it's just like, that's like the perfect opportunity to practice what I learned last year with in terms of equanimity. And like, it has tested it at times. There's been times where I've felt like I've kind of been out of balance, but I can't imagine how I would have approached this situation if I hadn't have done Vipassana, you know? So it's been a great tool, man. That's all it is. It's a tool just to help you stay at peak performance.
Definitely. And it couldn't have come at a better time. And we've discussed a bit here and there. And I think it's been challenging for a lot of people globally, especially, you know, Melbourne, Victoria. It's been tough where you are there in the CBD because, you know, you've got this curfew, which is now gone. You've had all these, you know, radius of 5Ks, you know, all these rules. And I feel like the masses are not dealing well with this, and no one's dealing well with this. Even people like yourself who have done this Vipassana, myself, we've all felt cabin fever. It's all been very, I guess, tough. So, you know, it's come at a good time. And in the Dharma as well, that's what they call it, there's a lot of wisdom, you know. People sometimes look at it as like, it's like, because it's a Buddhist meditation, but that I feel is distinctly different from like a religious meditation, because I don't know too much about it, but like the Buddhism component of it or whatnot is, it's not per se religious. It's more about giving to others. And that's what metta's about, is putting love and kindness into the world. And I find there's so much wisdom. Like one of the points you brought up before was you need to experience something experientially. Like it's easy to sit down and hear it from a teacher when they teach you something theoretical. Like he has three levels. He says there's the theoretical understanding. The second one is the emotional understanding. But the third one is the experiential understanding. When you actually feel it, like you said, you can't unsee that, and you feel it strongly inside you. And then you take that wisdom and, you know, you can apply into your life. So it's pretty cool, man. Do you think that the Vipassana meditation, do you think it's something everyone should do? Because honestly, man, it's tough, even for people like you and me who spend a lot of time by ourselves. We still found it challenging. And I think, you know, from what you say, everyone could benefit from it. But do you think everyone should, you know, take this 10-day undertaking? Because that's what you have to start off with.
It's a great question, man. I've thought about it and I'm not sure. I think anyone who wants to do it should do it, because if you're curious about it and your main reservation is just, could I actually do it? Or that sounds hard, I'm not sure if I want to do it. If that's you, I would recommend you just do it, because it is hard. It's very challenging. It's one of the hardest things I've done, but the hardest thing is actually just putting your name down and actually showing up on day one. Once you're there, you'll find a way to get through it. You know, it will be challenging. There'll be challenges. You'll want to leave at some point, all this stuff, but you will get through it. The hardest thing is actually just deciding to do it. So anyone who is curious and anyone who is just sort of doubting themselves or doubting whether they think they could do it, I would say yes. But I think you have to want to do it, because I even remember there was one guy who I spoke to on the last day of my retreat, and he was just asking me about my experience, and I was telling him all this stuff. And then I asked him about his, and he kind of was just like, oh yeah, like it was all right. Like, but I didn't really get that much. And I was thinking, oh, that's crazy. Like how can I have all these profound things happen? But he didn't get much out of it at all. And then as we talked more, he was just telling me all these things. He was like, oh yeah, like sometimes I'd like, instead of like meditating, I'd just go take a nap in my room, and like, or like I just wouldn't like meditate properly. I'd just kind of sit there and just think about what I was going to do after this or whatever. And then and I could just tell like he didn't take it seriously. Whereas like me, I took it deadly seriously. I did everything the guy said, Goenka. You know, he said, only eat two meals and don't eat a big lunch, because that you meditate better when you're hungry. And as much as I love food and I wanted to eat multiple meals, I was like, all right, if he says I'm going to do it. So I did everything to the letter, to the T of what they recommended, but some people didn't, and they didn't get as much of a benefit from them. So I can imagine people who aren't really that motivated and they're just kind of dipping their toes in the water, it's probably not worth doing. So you have to actually want to do it, and you have to be willing to commit to actually going all in for 10 days. And if you're willing to do that, you will get something out of it. Very profound.
For sure. You have to have that discipline. I think if you feel, as you said, you want to do it, for sure, go and do it. Definitely, this is what you advised me not to do, and I appreciated that at the time, is don't, if you want to do it, don't read up on Google about people's experiences, you know. You kind of know what it's about, and we don't want to scare you out of it, but it is, you know, I think it's a good exercise in discipline. There's no dinner served. You know, you get a small bowl of fruit and a cup of tea. You're waking up at, you know, 4:30 every morning and meditating, and it's phenomenal. So I think you're right. If you want to do it, do it. And as long as you make it past day one, you're fine, because some people try and escape, they try and get their car keys and just drive off, you know, after day one.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
So yeah, it's incredible, man. Thanks for sharing your experience. Let's talk about the podcast, man. I think it's nearly been 2 years now, a bit under 2 years, that you started your podcast, The James Harrison Show, where you interview startup founders and, you know, top performers doing big things. I mean, what made you want to start a podcast about 2 years ago?
Yeah, dude. Love the question. I think I've always seen the value in doing some form of content. You know, like, I've experimented with different things in the past. I've gone hard on Instagram. I've done like YouTube videos, just sharing things that I've been learning. I even did like writing and like blogging for a little bit, all this kind of stuff. And I guess I always saw the power or the potential power of creating content, because, you know, it's a good way to build an audience and become sort of like an authority in whatever niche that you're in, and all these other benefits that come from it. But nothing really like stuck in terms of all those other projects. And so really the podcast, the main reason I wanted to start it is because A, I wanted to have some sort of content channel. And then B, I listened to a lot of podcasts myself and I really enjoyed them. And when I listened to people conducting interviews, I actually, in my mind, I just thought, this is actually a medium that's conducive to my skill set, because this is actually like you interviewing me here. This is actually more challenging for me rather than the other way around, because I feel like I'm a good listener. I can ask good questions. I can guide a conversation well. All these things that is required for a good interviewer. But I find that easier than being on the other end and having to sort of talk a lot. So it just seemed like it was a good fit for my skill set. And I'm always running experiments in my life. That's one thing that's been consistent throughout my whole life. And so that's all this started as. It was just an experiment. I said to myself, you know, I know probably 5 to 10 people in my network who are pretty interesting and that I feel like I could have a good conversation with. Why don't I just commit to doing 10 episodes, 10 interviews? If I get to 10 and I like it, and I enjoy it, I'll keep going. If I don't, I'll just write it off and no harm done. And yeah, I just got to 10 and I really enjoyed it and felt like there was a lot of potential and value in it. So I decided to just keep going. And then here we are 2 years later.
Yeah, and you're 59 episodes in. It's been so cool to see your journey, man. And like you said, we had a discussion yesterday about this. It's crazy, man. Like, in terms of social media channels, like, you've obviously got Instagram, you got your Facebook, TikTok, etc. That's all kind of getting saturated. You know, you've got the new players, like, you know, TikTok still got a lot of organic reach, but it's mind-boggling, man. Podcasting, it's been around for, I'm not sure, 7 to 10 plus years, you know, in this element. It's been around for a long time, but it's still so underpenetrated. Like, people have podcasts and a lot of people do it, but there's really not that many thought leaders or people who are kind of running with it, you know, with podcasts. Mm. And I think a lot of people, you know, even in the startup world or even, you know, industry leaders, thought leaders, etc., some of them have one, but a lot of them don't, because they just have the simple belief that I don't know how to start a podcast. Yeah. Or, you know, I'm not sure if it's going to be good. And it's just crazy, man. Like, there's so much opportunity in the podcasting space. And I think that, you know, you're 59 interviews in, that's super powerful. What have you learned from your experience, you know, doing all this?
Mm. I love the question, man. So many things and so many different levels that I've learned, but there's actually been a few key things which have really stood out to me that I really took away as a whole. I could take as like general learnings from interviewing so many people. And the first one, which I think is actually really important, is that at the end of the day, people are just people. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the time, and I've been like this in the past, we sort of see these like personalities or these like influencer types or people who have achieved all these great things. And we kind of pedestal them in a way. We think that because they have all these great achievements, that they're amazing and they're on this high level, that way above us, we can never get to their level, this kind of stuff. And what's been fascinating for me is that I've had the luck and privilege of sort of being able to interview some of these high profile people. So people like, for example, Alex Icon, he's got like hundreds of thousands of followers, created a product called the 5-Minute Journal. It's a very successful e-commerce brand, among a few other things. I've interviewed Chris Ridd, the former managing director of the cloud accounting software Xero in Australia. So sort of like all these high profile people. And it's amazing to actually meet these people and talk to them and interact with them and see that they are just like you, essentially. And that's a really powerful mindset shift, because when you actually see these people that you perceived as on this crazy level that you could never reach, but then you meet them and you realize that they are just like you, that actually just resets the bar in your own mind of what you can achieve. Because, you know, I'm talking to these people and yes, they have amazing achievements, but, you know, we're actually quite similar. So if they can do that, why can't I? And it's not like disparaging them and saying they're not good, but it's just like I've been underplaying myself, you know? And so to actually see that, again, once you see it and once you experience it and it's experiential, you can't unsee it. And it's just powerful to know moving forward, man, because I can see so clearly in my mind now that that all the things that I always said that I wanted to do, but I didn't really believe that I could, I now know that they are actually possible for me. And it's just a matter of actually working and getting there. So that's been super powerful. Another thing is, it's been so many, man. I think that I'd say that's probably the main thing that I've learned from the podcast. So,
Yeah, I love that. And I think having that vision, as you said, firstly, seeing it at an experiential level, and then having that vision, you know, the utmost confidence in your abilities, obviously in a humble way, and also having the backing of other successful people when they can see what you're doing, that can kind of help as well. And seeing what you've gotten out of it. And I think podcasting, honestly, man, it's a great way to network. I don't think you necessarily entered it with the intention to build, you know, a network. Some people do that and that's good. But podcasting is a crazy good way to build a massive network, because, you know, for someone like yourself, you know, you've interviewed 57 different people. And, you know, you've been able to get into rooms, as you said, with people like, you know, Chris Ridd, the managing director or former managing director of Xero. You know, you've virtually interviewed Alex Icon, Dan Dembski. There's some people in the startup world, which is very interesting. So how have you approached networking, man? Because everyone has a different approach to it. Some people see it as, you know, I just need to build my LinkedIn connections and, you know, hand out all my business cards and get that out to people. Other people approach it from, say, a place of service. I mean, what's your unique approach been to networking? Because I think you've done a great job at building like a world-class network so far with the podcast.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I actually just see networking as relationship building, and I don't really separate the two, because, and this is something we've talked about previously, is that I've always observed the best networkers, or the people who have like the strongest connections with people generally, they blur those lines between business and personal. You know, it's like they do business with people that they like and that they also consider friends or acquaintances, and vice versa. Whereas I think a lot of people are very compartmentalized. They just think, I've got like my work and I'll go to like a trade show and network with people who are in that same industry or whatever. And then I've got my mates who I get pissed with on the weekend or whatever. And they're like two separate buckets. But the way I've approached networking, or how I've tried to approach it, and this is something I've consciously designed for myself and clarified, is that I only want to do business with people that I actually like on a personal level. Because I've done that in the past. I've worked for companies where I actually really don't like the clients. You know, like I'm managing these accounts and working directly with these people as their like account manager or whatever, and I don't even like them. Like, it's like the last thing I want to do is like go to their business and talk to them and listen to all their complaints and all this crap, you know? So I've had that in the past and it's not fulfilling for me. So now I'm very conscious in wanting to only do business, if possible, with people that I actually consider good people and people that I would actually go and have a beer with on the weekend or whatever, you know? And that's just part of having, I guess, like an integrated life of where work and play, they're not always the same, but they're not always separate as well, you know? And so that makes it easier as well to build a network, because I'm not just like slinging business cards or just getting the LinkedIn connection or whatever and just like trying to just see how does this person fit into my professional agenda. I can actually come from it as a place of, I actually want to invest in this person in this relationship, because even if I get nothing from it in terms of like professionally, like they don't become a client, they don't refer me to anyone, whatever, that's actually totally fine, because I actually consider them a friend or someone that I like, you know? And so there's a big difference between that. And the podcast, as you said, has just been a phenomenal tool to do that. And it's actually crazy, man, because like you and I have spoken about this a lot, but I think a lot of people don't know this, and like there's no reason why they would, but, and I still haven't figured it out myself, but for some reason a podcast carries this certain weight. Like you said, it's like people perceive, there's like a high perceived barrier to entry to a podcast. The reality is anyone can flick on their iPhone memo and just upload it onto Spotify and Apple Podcasts or whatever, and it's actually easy to do. But there's some sort of perception around it where it's like, if you have your own podcast, that means that you've like, I don't even know why. It's just like people are like, oh wow. Like when I tell people I have a podcast, like I think I've achieved nothing. Like I, in the grand scheme of things, like I've nothing compared to a lot of people, but people just hear that and I can just tell, man, they think it's like, they think it's interesting that I have a podcast and they want to learn more and they're curious about it. And like some of these people that I've interviewed, it's like they've actually done things that I consider to be great achievements. Like they've built businesses, had exits, like done all this cool stuff. And they're almost looking up to me as like this podcast host and thinking like, oh wow, like you have this podcast, you interview people, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just thinking like, why are you thinking that? Like I should be like glad to be in the room with you kind of thing. And so it's crazy, dude. And so it has unlocked a lot of doors. Like that example with Chris Ridd, like I literally just messaged him on LinkedIn and he just invited me to his house to record a podcast interview. And it's like, when can you do that without a podcast? Like I couldn't just message him and be like, hey, can I pop around to your house for a cup of coffee or whatever and just ask you a few questions off the record? Something about a podcast. So, you know, even literally if no one listened to the podcast, if no one downloaded it and I just got nothing in terms of an audience, I would actually still do the podcast, because all these other benefits of connecting with interesting people and having good conversations, that's actually the main benefit to me. The audience is almost like a secondary thing, you know?
That's totally right, man. And that's what my intention is for the podcast. Again, sometimes people have different intentions for starting it. They want to, you know, have download numbers and they want to monetize it. And it's funny, man, we've spoken about this off camera as well, is that, you know, as soon as we tell people that we're doing a podcast, like we have separate ones, you know, people jump to saying, how are you going to monetize it? And we tell them there's so many benefits, is that look, we're not doing it for the download numbers. If there's zero downloads for this episode or for all my other episodes, that's perfect. Like that's great, because my intention and my focus is not on that. It's about really just generally having great conversations with interesting people. And that's the reality, is that, you know, we have our weekly calls where we chat about things, and, you know, we would speak about, if we were to meet, you know, because say Chris Ridd at a networking event, we'd have those conversations anyway. So what we're really doing, so we're just turning on the mic, you know, we're trying to, you know, I guess share our conversations with other people, and it's really a secondary benefit, you know. It's not about, you know, vanity metrics or, you know, wanting to say be an influencer or any of this stuff per se.
Totally, man. I have the same mindset as well, for sure.
So yeah, it's awesome, man. Let's talk about lifestyle design. It's a topic that, you know, we've kind of had a bit of back and forth. We've done a previous episode a few months back, and we talked about lifestyle design and planning your life out. So a lot of people, they have goals and that's great. They have values and they know their strengths, which is good. But I feel like lifestyle design is the thing that ties everything together. We have a document that we've both written called the Life Manifesto, in which we write down our dream life in all areas of life, or all facets, you know, like what car do you have? You know, how do you feel when you're with your friends? How's your relationship? What's your contribution to society? How do you make your money, etc.? And when you do all this kind of stuff, I feel like you naturally attract those vibrations, because you know what you want and it kind of aligns you and you're able to go out there and kind of get what you want. So can you explain, like, what is lifestyle design to you, James, and how have you gone about it?
Mm-hmm. Love the topic, man. Lifestyle design for me is really, I love the quote from Stephen Covey where he says, begin with the end in mind. And I think it's such a good message because it's true. You have to begin with the end in mind. When you ask people, you know, like, what do you want? Like, what do you actually want your life to look like on a day-to-day basis? Most people can't answer that question. They might say, you know, I want to graduate with first class honors and work for KPMG as a partner or whatever. That's like you said, they've kind of got that goal. But it's like, lifestyle design is beyond that. It's like, what does your day-to-day look like? Sure, maybe that's your career and that's part of your lifestyle, but, you know, do you actually want to work 14 hours a day? Like, is that what you want? Or do you actually want to have the mornings to yourself so that you can do a 1 hour yoga session and work out in the morning and then start work? You know, it's just like, because that's the thing. Happiness in life is not a destination. It's not like having a 4 week holiday every year where you go to Europe and whatever. It's actually your day to day. You know, that's what's going to make you happy or unhappy. And a lot of people have that wrong because they think, how can I like sacrifice a portion of my life so that on another portion of my life, say Saturday and Sunday, I can live a life that I really enjoy and then just keep rinsing and repeating that every week. Whereas the way I want to approach my life is that, how can I design it so that every single day I wake up feeling refreshed with a burning desire to get to work and build something and go to sleep every night satisfied and fulfilled in all areas of my life? And of course, it's not going to be that every day. It's not realistic, but you at least want to have what that is defined. You want to at least define what that is for you so you have a compass and something to work towards. So for me, it's like there's a specific process I went through to create this document, which you mentioned before. And a lot of it is just asking these questions like, when have I felt the most happiest in my life? You know, what brings me joy? What are specific things that I enjoy doing on a day-to-day basis? You know, what's like my ideal living situation? Just all these like questions where it's trying to tease out like, what are the things that are actually going to bring you happiness? Because I'll give you a specific example for me. Like, one thing that brings me so much joy and that I love to do is to sit on a sun lounger in the morning in the sun, drinking a cup of coffee. You know, like I can't even tell you like how much joy that brings me. And that's not something I need like $10 million to do. You know, I can do that right now. So it's like, if I hadn't gone to the point of actually defining what that is, and that's one thing I've really learned from doing this whole process. Like at the end of the day, like I do have big goals, I have big dreams, but I'm actually a pretty simple person at the end of the day. Like the things that I want are not complicated. They're not unattainable. And now I have them like clearly defined so that I know what, whenever I presented like with a choice or like two directions I can go, I now have like this decision-making framework where I can say like, all right, I've said that I like seeing the sun in the morning and this opportunity is going to mean that I can't do that. That's just a very simplified example, but that's one part of it. It's like, well, if it's actually taking away from my ideal lifestyle, is it something I actually want to say yes to? You know, when you actually have this framework to make decisions, things become very, to say yes or no becomes very simple, you know? Like one of the other criteria I had was, you know, I want to have complete freedom of schedule and also freedom of location. So, you know, that makes it very clear for me when I'm assessing opportunities, whether I want to say yes or no to this, because if it's something that is going to limit that freedom, then it's probably not the right path for me. And it's not to say that I'm going to turn down every opportunity that does that, because sometimes there might be an opportunity that I can take, which in the short term takes away that freedom, but then the long term allows me to have it. So that's like another layer to it. But, you know, for me, if I think of like do I want to become like a CEO of a publicly traded company, for example? That does not tick many boxes of what I want. It ticks the income box for sure, but it doesn't tick the freedom box that I have, which is a very high value of mine. It doesn't tick like the my daily schedule of what I want, like what's my perfect day. No way it's going to fit that. And so, you know, it's kind of like, it just helps you make these decisions and make sure that you're on the right path for what you actually want. Because if you don't define what you want, you don't have any sort of framework to work towards. And so when you don't do that, someone else will define that for you. And that person usually doesn't have your best interests in heart, because it's either advertisers who want to sell you something, or like government who wants to put you down a certain path, or your parents want to push you this way or whatever. And so having that clearly laid out for yourself means that you're making decisions that you actually are in your best interest, not in someone else's. And that's why I think it's a powerful exercise to do.
It definitely is, man. I think, as you said as well, it's like a decision-making framework. You know, if you, you're at a crossroads and you don't know what decision to make. Do I take this job that pays me, you know, 55K? Or do I take the job that pays me 90K, but I'm working 95 hours a week? Because if you don't have this, you know, guiding principle or framework, a lot of people, including myself in the past, we just jump for the higher money because we think, oh, well, yeah, that's fine. You know, I'll take more money and things will work themselves out. And they won't, you know, they will happen as they're meant to. And we've discussed that before, like in terms of money. If you earn more money, not always, but oftentimes you lose that money because you get lonely and you spend that money on compensating for, you know, loneliness or feelings of just complete lack inside.
Absolutely, man. And that's a simple example, which people will be able to wrap their heads around. But, and that's obvious, but there's all these small things as well. It's like, you know, one of the things that I love is that I love sitting in the sun, like I said before. So, you know, when I'm deciding about like, where do I want to live? That's actually going to be a big factor for me, because I probably don't want to go live in like Scandinavia in the winter, you know, where there's only like 2 hours of sunlight a day and like snow and cold and all that kind of crap. Like, you know, so that's when you actually define what you want, that just makes all those decisions really easy to assess and make a decision on. And another saying I love is, which I think is why this is so important, is that the worst thing in life is climbing the ladder of success, whatever that looks like. And you finally get to the top of the ladder after 20 years or whatever. But once you get to the top, you realize it was leaning against the wrong wall the whole time. And that's what happens to a lot of people. They chase the money, or they chase something which they think is what they want. And they think it's going to make them happy and fulfilled. But they get to the top after putting in all this work, thinking this is going to be the pinnacle. But then they realize once they get there, they still have that deep sense of unfulfillment. And they realize it's like, fuck, I just wasted the last 20 years of my life. So, and I've done that in the past. Like I was climbing, I didn't get to the top. I was like climbing up the wrong ladder. And I got to a point where I realized that. And so I had to take a big step back. So I had to literally climb down that ladder after all that work I'd put in, and then take the ladder, find the right wall to begin with, and then put that ladder up against the right wall. And now I'm in the process of climbing that. And as a result, I feel more fulfilled. I feel happier. I feel like I'm on the right trajectory. And everything is just falling into place in that regard. So that's another important point.
Yeah, for sure, man. It's definitely a deep process of self-mastery. It's crazy they don't teach us in school. And in a way, that's also good, because that means the people who learn it have a competitive advantage. But, you know, even things like values, you know, I think we've chatted about a lot of things, and there will come a time, maybe sooner or later, where, you know, we'll sit down maybe with some other mutual friends and just kind of put together all these frameworks. There's so many, you know, tools that we've used and different things that have kind of helped us on this lifestyle journey, like defining your values for men, you know, purpose and mission. That's so phenomenally important. And it's something that I don't think I've 100% defined it. You know, I'm 80% of the way there, but there's still more to go. So how would you recommend, you know, people do this lifestyle design for themselves? You know, people listening right now, they'd be very inspired to hear what you've said. And, you know, also during the pandemic, you said on another interview that, you know, you were getting, you know, offers, you know, six-figure income offers during the pandemic. And that's crazy, because a lot of people's mindset is, well, you know, we're in a recession. There's no jobs. There's no work. Like, I can't do anything right now. But you were getting offers and you were able to turn to that life manifesto and say, cool, the money is like mid six figures. That's awesome. But unfortunately, it just doesn't meet these non-negotiable criteria and the essential qualities of how I want to work my life around it. So how would you recommend, you know, people listening, how can they start the process of even considering lifestyle design and putting it into practice?
Yeah, dude, I love the question. And really, I'll walk you through the specific process that I undertook. Everyone's sort of welcome to do what works for them. But what I did for myself is that I basically dedicated an entire day. So blocked out a whole day on my calendar to work on this, which is quite a big commitment, but it's worth doing because the way I see it is like you dedicate one day to set you up for the rest of your life. And what I did was I basically got up early. I meditated for an hour. That's optional, but it sort of puts me in a clear headspace. And what I had done the night before is in a blank journal, I'd written out a bunch of writing prompts. So things, like I said before, those questions like, when have I felt the most happiest in my life? What brings me joy? What does my perfect day look like, both a work day and also a non-work day? And just kind of like having these few prompts where it just makes you think about like, what do I actually want? Because that's the difference. Like when you ask people, what do you want? It's a hard question to answer. But when you have these sort of freestyle prompts, that helps you dig a bit deeper and find out what are the actual things that make you happy. And then what I did was I went to a cafe back when cafes were open in Melbourne. And I basically, it was somewhere completely new. So I'd never been to the cafe before because I think there's power in changing your environment. You could even do like a retreat somewhere, just like hire a cabin in the woods for a few days or whatever the case may be. Go to a new location. And all I did, my phone was off. I didn't check my phone or check my emails or anything that day. So my mind was completely clear. And I just sat in that cafe for literally 3.5 hours. And I just had a pen and those prompts and blank pieces of paper. And I just wrote whatever came to my mind. So I had these questions which I answered. But then when I had random thoughts and tangents, I'd just write this out. And what ended up happening was I had like 20 pages of random notes of just things that came to my mind of times I had felt the happiest, things that I thought I wanted, all these bits and pieces of different areas of life. And then what I did was I went back to my apartment, again, still phones off, and I basically just sat in front of the computer and just typed out, sort of compiled all these notes. So you've got different bits and pieces here and there from 20 pages. And then I just condensed it into something that was a bit more coherent and sort of broken into sections. So, you know, like, you've got like your relationships, your career, your travel, you know, like friendship groups, inner circle, outer circle, networking, where do you live, all these different like areas of life. Basically just think of anything that's an aspect of lifestyle, just group them into different points and just type it out and then see what comes out. And that's what I did. It probably took about 8 hours total, including so the brain dump and then also compiling it all. But then what I had at the end of the day was this document, which I still read regularly. And it's basically, it's a 14-page document, which basically just has my ideal life set out and laid out, which is crazy, man, because it's been such a useful tool. And it's not meant to be set in concrete. Like I've actually added things, I've removed things, I've changed things. It's a Google Doc, not a PDF, so you can always change it. But it's crazy, dude, because I did this about a year ago and there were certain things I wrote on there which I thought were going to take me like 5-10 years to achieve, which have actually come into fruition already. One example is having location independence. I thought that was something that was going to take years for me to achieve, but I have that now, you know. Apart from coronavirus, I could go wherever I wanted to, you know. I'm not stuck to like one location. That was a big goal of mine. And now that's a reality in less than 1 year. And I think there's a power to actually writing things down and having it there and reading it regularly, because you could say it's like the law of attraction. And I do believe it to an extent, but I don't think in the way that most people think of it. I think of it as just if you have something specific written down and you review it regularly, all that does is it plants the seed in your subconscious mind of this is what I want and this is what I'm going to look for. So when I was sort of assessing like what do I do next, that was always in the back of my mind. Like I need like location independence, like all these things. And so it just helped me like filter out all the opportunities that were relevant and helped me achieve that. So that's the process I went through. And I think it's pretty good. I actually did an Instagram post on it a while ago if you want to see the exact questions and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, dude, it's worth doing. And it's brought me a lot of clarity in a lot of different areas.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. We'll make sure we'll link that post in the show notes. And I think it's an important iteration to remember that this life manifesto, it's a living document, you know? It's not concrete, as you said. I'm on my second or third iteration. I'm sure you're on the same as well. It's a Google Doc, so you can edit it. You want to edit it and revise it. It's up to you. You don't want to do it every week. Like, you can. It's really up to you. But I feel the most benefit comes from reviewing it from 3 to 12 months. And that kind of ties into our next topic, you know, say on relationships, is that at a point in time, we think we want something. And then as we go through different experiences in life, you know, we get burned or, you know, or something great happens. We can, it clarifies and narrows down what do we actually want from life. And we take these experiences and are able to manifest, you know, something that we want. Because a lot of guys, you know, in the infancy, they want a woman who has a nice butt, you know, who's attractive and all this. But when they get older, they may realize, well, look, you know, I want to focus on family building. I want to focus on, you know, as you said, building a location independence and a woman who can support my mission. And you can also support her mission and her vision. And you guys can work together to build like a good union of poison stability. So in terms of relationships, it's crazy, man. Now we're on this path where we're studying relationships and parenting. And it sounds a bit weird. Some people, you know, make fun of me or whatever, saying like, why are you studying dating? It's so weird. And we're not studying pickup artist stuff. It's not like low level tactical stuff. We're studying the frameworks of, you know, what makes a good relationship, even parenting. We're thinking about, you know, family building right now. You know, I'm 23, you've just turned 30. And it's something that I think needs to be studied years ahead, not just say 6 to 9 months before. You really need to put thought into it. So, I mean, what have you learned from relationships, man? Because, you know, we've had some conversations in off the podcast where you've been through some experiences and you've learned some incredible things, not just about relationships, but you've also learned life lessons that you've been able to, I guess, you know, it's widened your perspective and, you know, shown you different things about yourself and people in general.
Absolutely, man. Oh, don't even know where to start with the relationships. I love it, dude. I always think, and I've always found that without exception, all the biggest growth experiences that I've had in my life have always come about from romantic interactions. And usually that comes from like extreme pain in the moment, which is fine. And yeah, it's just good, dude. Like some context for people listening, like about a year and a half ago, I ended like a long-term relationship I was in. And then, so the past year and a half has really been like, I mean, it's like started as like a deep inner journey and sort of not involving other people, which I think is necessary. In terms of like maximizing your spiritual growth, I guess there's a time where you should be by yourself and not involve other people. But then there comes a point where to maximize that growth, you should involve other people. And so that's kind of what it's been for me like the past probably like 6 months or so. It's just been interesting, man. Like, because again, it's just there's like just reading people, man, like understanding who people are, seeing them objectively, like, you know, I've had some train wreck experiences with certain people and it's just like, and I love it, man. It's like so good because even though like there's like specific examples I can think of, which were very hard at the time and that caused me like a lot of pain and like deep inner reflection and whatnot, but it's actually fucking great, man, because that person like taught me so much. I actually believe it, man. It's like you always get served by the universe, the people who you need in that moment. Even if it seems like it's not what you want. And it always makes sense when you look back why that person was there. You know, it's crazy, man. It actually feels to me like these people, certain people have been dumped into my life for literally no other reason other than to teach me an important lesson about myself, which I wasn't willing to to learn. And I was forced to learn that lesson through that person. And then they just like disappeared from my life. And I was like left at the time in like pain. But looking back, I'm like so grateful for it, you know? And then I think about like, wow, how good is it that I learned that lesson through that person then when it was like low risk? Like there wasn't, it wasn't complicated. There wasn't like any like long-term consequences from that, any children or anything like that. I just got to learn that lesson and then move on. And then there's been times since that person where I've then encountered someone similar, but just straight away, I'm just like, no, that person is like not good for me. Like I may feel like magnetic attraction towards that person, but I know from my past experience, which I learned, that that person is no good for me. And so it's just, it's good, man. It just refines that like detector, that bullshit detector of like, what do you actually want? What do you need? And what are the things you should avoid? And that's all it's been, man. It's just been a gradual, sometimes I really do feel like it's a process of elimination in a way, or a process of refinement. You know, you start with, you say you want these things, whether it's the nice ass or whatever, like the certain traits, but then it's like you experience one person and then you're like, okay, those things about that person were good, but then these things, they're not bad, but like they didn't serve me and I couldn't serve her with those certain things that she had. So that's not going to be a fit in the future. And you just gradually and gradually narrow your focus until you have a very fine, like, it's not even like a checklist or criteria, but it's like, you know, that the certain types of people or certain things that people do that if they do, they're just not a fit for you. And nothing's like completely black and white. There's always some gray area, but you can say with some certainty that that is the case. And so like for me, like I just feel like I have a lot more clarity on the sort of person, first of all, that I want to be in a relationship, because that's the first step, is being the person who can actually serve and bring something to that relationship, but then also what the other person looks like and how they can serve me. And so, yeah, dude, it's just been, there's been a lot of learnings that helped me refine that over the past year or so.
Yes, that's true, man. It's crazy. I think for guys, and I look at myself as well, we're on this journey. One of the best skills you can possess, especially in dating and before you're in like a serious long-term relationship and into family building, is to immediately know when someone is not for you. And I've come to the stage now where I feel like, you know, even just meeting the person or just even seeing the Instagram or seeing the way they interact on like a story or whatever, I can tell straight away if this person is good or not. And the reality is I will never know if that's true, but you're so true, is that.
Not with certainty, but with high probability.
With high probability, and that's right, you only need to win once, you know, you only need to find that one partner and, you know, set up a future, and that's great, and make whatever you want of it. And, you know, people say there's a lot of fish in the sea, so you can be selective. And in terms of relationships, I think it's so important, as you said, to first to fix yourself. Once you fix yourself, you holistically, you know who you are, what direction you're going, and also clearing up a lot of inner internal issues, you know, like Vipassana we talked about, that helps a lot, bringing self-awareness, because people have, you know, traumas and they might not even be deep-rooted. They just may have been, you know, a boss yelled at you and therefore you have like a trauma to authority figures or things like that. So you need to fix yourself and then you can bring your best self to the relationship. And what you said as well, I love, is that people always have a taker mindset, and it's not always from a bad place. They're thinking, is this person good for me? Can they do this for me? And it's always me, me, me. But how I like to think of it, and I think how you see it as well, is we come from an abundance mindset, a place of service. We want to think, okay, are they good for me? But am I good for them? Can I serve them at the highest level in terms of their spiritual growth? And I had to end a, you know, relationship, or was like, you know, dating someone, and, you know, it was, I guess you could say, somewhat comfortable, but I just knew that I was holding back their spiritual growth and I couldn't serve them at the highest level. And by me staying in that situation, I'm actually being selfish to them. I'm robbing them of that spiritual growth. So I think approaching it from a place of abundance, but also, you know, it's a good book that we've read, man. The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. Fantastic book. It's actually on the cover photo of my podcast. So you guys should go check it out if you love spiritual growth and relationships. But Yeah, you've said you've learned all these things. Can you name a few tangible ones? I think one that you mentioned before is, you know, not pedestaling people and seeing them for who they are. I think that's really important.
Yeah, dude. That's a big one, is understand, just actually see people and assess them based on who they are and what they actually demonstrate, not on what you project them to be or what you think they could potentially be in the future. That's the biggest key, because there's so many times where I've seen someone and when I look back, so obviously when you first interact with someone, there's a bit of that like honeymoon phase or whatever, you sort of consciously ignore the flaws or whatever. But then when I like look back with a clear head, I've realized that even at that time, I knew, like I saw those things and I knew that they were there. But I chose to ignore them, or I chose not to see them and only focus on the perceived good things and also what I was projecting, because there's a lot of gaps, especially when you first meet someone. There's things you don't know about them, and our tendency is to just fill those gaps with our fantasies or what we think that they might be. And it's just the worst thing you can do, man, because it's not reality. It's delusional, you know? And that's why, you know, I very rarely these days, like, because that's, I actually believe that, man, that if you like fall in love with someone quickly or like have this like intense attraction to them very fast, that I can't see a case where that comes from a good place. Because
yes,
it's you really don't know that person. Like we've talked about this before, it takes at least like 18 months, 2 years to actually fully know someone. You need to live with them, travel with them, see them at their best, see them at their worst, see how they interact with other people, all this kind of stuff before you actually know someone. And that usually takes about 2 years. So if you're in the situation where it's like love at first sight or whatever, I just don't believe it, man, because how can you, if you have that intense attraction and feeling, then all, in a lot of cases, and this has been the case for me in the past, and I think for most people, is that all it is they're pushing your like trauma buttons based on like some experience you had in the past, whether it's like with a parental figure or whatever. And all they're doing is like pushing that emotional wound, and it's triggering it in you and causing this like intensity and this like this passion, but it's coming from a place of lack, not a place of fulfillment. And you know, and when you take that and you project that as being love, you're actually deluding yourself, because you are filling in so many gaps with fantasies that you have in your mind of what that person you think that they might be, and you're not allowing them to reveal who they are over time and seeing them for who they are. So I feel I'm very much like in a place now where I feel very emotionally equanimous about most people. Like I rarely see someone and think that, oh wow, like they're so amazing, blah, 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 because I've seen it, man. Like, as you said, I've been burnt by people in the past where it's like they project one thing about themselves, which is one thing, but the reality turns out to be completely different. And it doesn't mean to say that I'm like cynical or anything. Like maybe some people would interpret it that way. I don't think I'm cynical at all. I think I just see things as they are, which I actually think is powerful. So that's probably one of the biggest specific things I've learned, man.
It's so amazing. I feel that, you know, we've both had this similar experience as you've shared there, where we kind of pedestal people, and you're right, it totally comes from the inner wounded child, you know, the child when we were younger. You know, we may have not got some attention that we needed. We may have been reprimanded or bullied or whatever. And that's kind of created these core wounds and sankharas, like we said before in Vipassana terms. And yeah, it's crazy, man. It's crazy. It's a massive process of like entropy and decay when we start from young emotionally, because, you know, we're just going through society and without the right guidance, and not even guidance. It's like, it's good to kind of get like wounded and hurt to learn lessons and to grow. That's phenomenal. But I think there really comes a time when people should like take some time out. And that's what I'm doing right now, you know, taking a good 6 months, maybe longer if need be, to not focus on, you know, relationships and dating and all that, and to take time to discover the purpose, or my unique purpose. That's what guys should do. Because the reality is, before you can give your best self to the relationship and even, you know, for parenting later on and family building, you need to heal yourself. So things like codependency, removing them, becoming holistically, you know, integrated with what you want and defined it, and also, you know, living elements of that life. So yeah, so true, man. Those codependency bonds, and, you know, there's so much inner work stuff, which we probably don't have time to get into. There's so much to talk about, but, you know, it's so important to embark on that journey. And you've done that yourself, man. You know, you had an experience, you know, probably just over a year ago, where you were, you know, you've talked about on Instagram publicly, you were left in tears in a hotel, and that really like shook you to the core. And I think, you know, you hit rock bottom at that moment, and you've just, you know, taken time out, been deliberate on your learning process and journey. So
yeah,
it's awesome, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. And it is so true. And I love what you said, man. It's, I fucking believe it, dude. You've got to, because here's the thing, when you like pursue other people and you are actively like trying to find someone or date different people or whatever, well, that's fine. Like there's a time and place for that, for sure. But what you're really doing is, in a way, you're trying to fit square pegs into round holes, essentially, because you're taking these random people who, like, you don't know anything about them, especially like if you just meet someone on the street or you meet them through an app or whatever. Even if it's like an introduction through a friend, like the reality is that person is on their own journey, on their own trajectory. And it's the chances of them like perfectly meshing with you and your own stage and what you want and what they need, and vice versa, is quite low, just like random probability. So, you know, when you're trying to do that, it's such a distraction, and it causes so much friction for the most part, because you're putting energy into people and trying to make things work, and it's like a lot of effort and you're not really getting any benefit from it. Whereas, you know, if you take that same energy that you're putting into that and just invest it in yourself and build yourself up, then you become magnetically attractive to the kind of person that you actually need, you know. And so it's like all that stuff, all that energy that you're putting in, you could have just put in yourself and developed yourself. And then it's almost like a filtering process. Like you make yourself vibrate on such a high level that you can't help but attract other people at the same vibration. And it's almost like the shortcut, man. It's like, why like try and date like hundreds of people and trying to filter one person out of those hundreds, when you can just make sure that you're the best version of yourself and that you're ready to receive what you say you want, which is another thing. And then just let that person come in when they make themselves available. Because I believe it, man. For me personally, like, I actually believe, and it'd be interesting to see if this is how it plays out, but I'll say on the record what my bet is that the person that I end up spending my life with, like my partner, will come about in a very organic and serendipitous way. And it will come from a result of me just choosing to invest all this energy into myself and just letting that person come whenever they come. Maybe it's 1 year from now, maybe it's 5 years from now. That's fine. I'm a patient person. I'm happy to wait. But that's, I really believe that that's what will happen. Whereas too many times people are trying to force things out of a place of lack, out of loneliness, or just feeling like they need to get married before they're 30 or whatever external BS pressure. And as a result, that's why 50% of marriages end in divorces. And probably out of those 50% that don't get divorced, 80% of them are probably miserable. And it's because people aren't willing to do that deep inner work for themselves. And they're just trying to force square pegs into round holes, you know?
Great point, man. I love that. And yeah, people think, you know, it's selfish if I work on myself, and I get that perspective, but really you need to fix yourself. It's like, you know, on airplanes, they say, put your mask on before helping the child or before helping, you know, the, you know, people next to you or whatever. So so important to take time to work on yourself. And it's funny, man. It's like the best things with the highest value or highest perceived value in life sell themselves, like Vipassana, man. The retreat sells out in 2 minutes. It's free. You just got to register online. A Bruno Mars concert, all these things, they're gone. So it's like, it's not meant to sound arrogant, and I don't think it is at all. But if you take time, as you said, to holistically really fix your life, and you vibrate such radiant happiness and love and kindness, and you're on purpose, people around you, they're going to be like, not physically, but they'll be knocked back, man. They can feel your vibrations. And, you know, people love happy people. They want to be surrounded by, you know, joyful people. So I feel like that is the best approach. Again, we can't, kind of summarize it for guys. Everyone's individual situation will always be unique, but I think doing what's in the best interest of your spiritual growth, and never forget your partner's spiritual growth. That's so important, because you can't win unless they're winning. If you're both winning, you go to the moon and back, you know, but if one of you's winning and not, you know, it's going to break up and things will fall apart. So Yeah, I appreciate you sharing your insights on relationships and things, James. Let's move to a few rapid fire questions to close off the interview. What's the most controversial opinion you own right now?
Most controversial opinion. Oh, man. I mean, I don't know how controversial it is, but I really believe that you can actually have everything you want in life. You know, most people say that, you know, be realistic. You have to compromise. Like, there's sacrifices you have to make, all this kind of stuff. And it's such an ingrained belief, and I've always had that belief in the past. But the more I just go through life, and the more I learn, and the more I observe people who live lives that I look up to, and not just projections of what they put out, but like actually knowing them as a person, I actually believe it, man. You can have wealth, you can have freedom, you can have fulfillment. You can live your life on your own terms and do the things that you want to do. It's not going to be like every day. Like, not every day is like blissful, but on the macro, you shouldn't compromise. You should actually want and strive to have everything you want, and approach it from that mindset, and don't actually settle for less than you want, which is what most people do. They don't even try. Like, it's just such an ingrained belief that it's like, well, I can either make money and then like limit my freedom, or I can have more freedom but less money. It's like, why don't I have both, you know? It's like I was talking to another friend recently about, like, you know, would we rather, for our living situations, like, would we prefer to live in nature, or would we prefer to live in cities? Because there's pros and cons to both. And it's like, well, why are we even thinking like that? Why not have both? Have like one property in the city, one property in the country, you know? And it's just like,
yes.
I just think it's a good mindset to approach life of just don't limit yourself before you've even started, and start with your ideal situation. And then, you know, like, you can always scale it back if you need to or whatever. But I actually believe it, man. It's just with enough work and sometimes the short-term sacrifices, you can actually have everything that you want.
Love it, man. Very controversial. What's the most painful growth experience you've had?
Most painful growth experience, you said? Is that what you said?
Yeah, most painful one viscerally, where you felt like, wow, this is really hurting me emotionally, but you learned the most as well.
Well, as I said before, it's always romantic experiences. And I think, yeah, the most painful one I had was last year. And it was kind of like, it's painful for multiple reasons, because first of all, I ended a long-term relationship, which was many years. And so that in itself was painful. But the funny thing is, like, and we've spoken about this before, and I believe this as well, is that eventually you have to face pain. You can't avoid it. You can only defer it. And the longer you defer it, the worse it gets. So in this situation, like, there was pain, but I kind of deferred the pain by pursuing something with someone else, which was like not a great idea. And then there was kind of this moment where, like, I'd sort of deferred the pain from my past relationship, and then I'd like dumped all my baggage on this new person. But then that ended up being a complete train wreck, which obviously would have been, because I wasn't in the right mental state. But in that moment, and the moment you mentioned before, like sitting in the hotel room crying, was like that moment. That was when I actually realized it's like, wow, I had actually just deferred all this pain. And now it's like coming back like twice as hard. And there's like multiple layers now. It's like not just like the long-term relationship, it's like this new thing as well. And it all just sort of came into existence at once. And yeah, it's fucking hard, man. Like that's literally like emotionally, that was like the most rock bottom moment of my life. And it was like, that was the reason it was so challenging is because I was like, I was an empty shell of a man at that time, man. Like I didn't have like a clear purpose or like mission that I was working towards. I was trying to use other people to fill voids, emotional voids in myself. And I wasn't like facing inner problems that I needed to face. And so it's kind of just like this perfect storm moment where all those realizations just came to the surface. And I literally had nowhere to hide. I was just like sitting in this hotel room and I just was forced to face it. And I couldn't escape anywhere or escape with anyone. And it was just like, oh shit. And so that was kind of the starting point and the foundation of the last 12 months of the biggest growth period of my life, I would say. So again, looking back, super grateful for it. But at the time, it was a dark moment.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, man. That's so powerful. And you just turned 30 recently. What are some of the main life lessons you've learned? You've kind of said some on the call, but, you know, if you had to summarize, like, what are some of the kind of errors that you've learned are the most, you know, say from 20 to 30?
Great question, man. We've kind of already talked about it, but the biggest one is just like define what success is for yourself, you know, without external input. Because when you're chasing some form of success, whatever that is, if it's not yours, your definition of success, like we said before, it's someone else's definition of success. So whether it's your parents or society or whatever. And the worst thing is to like achieve that success, but then realize it wasn't actually what you wanted. And, you know, like deep down, when you're chasing something you don't really want, you actually know that deep down. You might not know consciously, but it manifests itself in so many different ways. It creates like this internal friction, which I've experienced myself, because in the past I was chasing things that actually weren't important to me, like, you know, status of this or like this person's expectation or society, blah, 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 whatever. I was chasing all these things and then that was causing all this friction. And it's funny, man. Like we're talking about like things manifesting in different ways. Like I used to always like get injured. I used to always get sick. I used to like have like skin issues. I used to like have like all these like problems. And I truly believe that part of the reason for all them was because it was like I knew like deep down that I was like chasing the wrong things. And so, but because I wasn't willing to face that and process it, it was just like, again, kinking that hose and it was manifesting in different ways. And so it's tragic, man. Like I can't imagine. I'm so glad and so grateful that I was able to take myself out of that and actually reflect and define what success was for me personally so that I could work towards that. Because it's crazy, dude. It's like, some people say like 30 is old or they feel old when they're 30 or whatever. But honestly, I'm in like the best health of my life, the best shape of my life, physically, mentally. I feel like so much energy every day. I feel that I'm on the right path and everything's just like flowing. And that can always change. Like nothing's permanent. But, you know, I just think that all of that came about because I took the time to actually define what success was for me. And I think 20s, is the time to do that. You know, it's like, and another lesson from my 20s is that that is really what it should be. You know, it's an exploratory period. So many people are just trying to optimize for money or short-term success or whatever in their 20s. So, you know, they like study hard, get the investment banking job, start making multi-six figures or whatever. but they're like miserable as hell. Whereas I would rather do what I did, which was like stumble around and like try different things and fuck up and make all these mistakes in my 20s and have nothing to show for it, essentially. Like I had very little to show for it materially, but it set me up in such a good position going into my 30s now. I still feel like a kid. I still feel like I'm 18 years old. And so like this decade and beyond, I'm just going to be executing. But it's on the right path, you know? I was saying to you in a previous conversation, Ryan, like in previous, like I've met so many people who like were like ex-bankers or whatever, but now they like after they turned 40 and they got sick of like doing coke in the bathroom and like hating their life or whatever. So now they've like cashed out, or not even cashed out, like they didn't have any money because they spent it all. And now they're like doing what they actually want to do. And it's like, it's so much better to just start from zero rather than go the wrong direction than have to go back to zero and then start when you're 40, you know? So yeah, fuck around in your 20s. Just learn what you like, what you don't like, define what success is for yourself, and then just execute hard and live a happy life.
So good, man. Great advice for people listening in their 20s. You're right. Got to define success and always make sure, you know, your ladder is not against the wrong wall. Like the worst thing in life to get is to get good at the wrong thing. Like if you get really good at flipping, you know, burgers or whatever, like you might be the best burger flipper in the world, but you hit 30, you're like, shit, I actually, this is not for me. That would be, you know, pretty bad. And also, man, what's coming up for you? You know, 2020 is about to end. It's been a crazy year, you know, a lot of growth, a lot of learning experiences. What's coming up for you as we, you know, close off these 3 months and also into 2021?
Yeah, dude. So right now I've kind of got two main projects. One is the podcast, which I haven't been going as hard on recently just because I've been pretty hard on it for almost 2 years and I'm still working on it, but I'm allowing some blank space so that I can really define exactly what I want to get out of it and how I can bring the most value from it. And so that then I can, once I have that clarity, I can execute hard. So I'll continue to work on that throughout the rest of this year and beyond. I'm also working on an e-commerce brand with one of my friends and his brother, which has been a great learning experience. I've been doing that, helping them as that business scales the past 12 months, almost 12 months now. And that's been really great because it's a project that ticks a lot of my boxes in terms of like freedom and income and all these kind of key metrics that I have for myself. So, and I'm learning a lot. So I will keep working on that brand and try to grow that. And yeah, those are sort of my main projects. And I just want to keep going, man. Just keep executing. I feel like I have a lot of clarity on what I need to do in those projects. I want to keep working on my health and improving my physical performance as well. And just keep going, man. Just keep executing.
It's awesome, man. And lastly, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to pass on to the audience?
That's a good question, man. I think one quote that we talk about a lot and I think is really relevant in so many different areas is just to be so good at what you do that they can't ignore you, you know, be so good that they can't ignore you, because everyone's trying to like do things or like get ahead. They're like, how do I grow my podcast? How do I like grow my Instagram? How do I make this money? How do I stand out in like a saturated market? Blah, blah, blah. They're asking all these questions, and they're looking for like tactical advice. But the reality is, sure, you can, there's a place for tactics and whatnot, but just be so good at what you do that literally people just cannot ignore you. I saw a funny Instagram post the other day. It was there's like a documentary guy, David Attenborough, who's like started an Instagram account, and in 24 hours he got like 3.4 million followers, I think. And it's like there was no hack that he did to like fix the algorithm, or like he didn't post like three times a day and use these hashtags or whatever. He was just so good at his craft, which is something that he's been working on for the past 60 years, that literally all he had to do was create something and people came to him. He was so good at his craft that people literally couldn't ignore him. And I think it's just a good lesson, because everyone's looking for that shortcut and they want to find the way to accelerate their growth, which is fine. There's like times to do that for sure and exploit arbitrage opportunities where they exist. But at a fundamental level, man, it's just, I always say that, just be so good that people can't ignore you and you will always get what you want.
Love that point, man. It's so underestimated and so important for everyone listening. So thanks so much for coming on the show, James. I appreciate you and your time today. I'll make sure that we link up your social media accounts in the show notes. You're quite active on Instagram. You know, James posts a lot of good content. So guys, go check him out. He's on Facebook. He's got the podcast. I'll put all the links there. But again, thank you so much for coming on the show, James. I appreciate you sharing a lot of wisdom and things that, you know, we've been talking about.
Yeah, of course, Ryan. And I just want to say as well for you, like, congrats on starting this journey with the podcast, because I've actually said it in the past that, you know, there is a somewhat higher perceived barrier to entry in terms of the podcast for a lot of people. Like, they think it's hard, and the reality is like, anyone can do it, but not everyone can do it well. And I just know, like, even before you started interviewing people, Ryan, I always said that, like, you would make a great host because you're a fantastic listener. You're very conscientious. You ask good questions. You go deep. And so I'm just really looking forward to what you do with this podcast and see how it grows over time, because you've already got some really interesting guests that you're interviewing, and that's only going to increase over time. And you're good at extracting all the good stuff out of people, and you're going to share some great content. So thanks for having me today.